know, it does relate to sustainability in the sense of like, why would I want to sustain when I could thrive? And so it's in the same field of that. But it's also harder to like know what it is when it's not a straight line. And sustainability often has a lot to do with the environment, and thrivability also includes play and culture and art, or, you know, it's got a lot more dimensionality. Are we thriving if we just have a garden, or no, do we also need to have music and philosophy, right? Like, it includes more dimensionality than I think sustainability has traditionally included.
Culture hacker, facilitator, and author Gene Russell joins John and Scoop on this week's Plutopia podcast. We discuss thrivability, healthcare, twisting language for political gain, social media, and much more.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Plutopia podcast. I'm John Lubkowski, and I'm here with Scoop Sweeney. And we're going to be interviewing Gene Russell. Gene engages in social ecosystem design, culture hacking, and facilitation as a visionary, but also as a pragmatist. Gene acted as the project lead for the Holo ICO, which raised 30,000 Ethereum, valued at $22 million at the time. In 2016, with Herman Vogter, she published Cultivating Flows, How Ideas Become Thriving Organizations, a book which explored through leading-edge practitioners what patterns enable healthy emergence. In 2013, Gene published Thrivability, Breaking Through to a World That Works, also with Triarchy Press. In 2010, Gene curated 65 inspiring people to create, including myself, by the way, Thrivability, a collaborative sketch, which has been seen by over 50,000 viewers. She has published articles on organizational design strategies, and her work on thrivability, innovation, philanthropy, and cultural shifts has been highlighted in various publications, including The Economist, the Harvard Business Review, and Stanford Social Innovation Review. As recognition for her work, Gene received an honorable mention on the Enrich list as one of the top 200 people enriching our path to a sustainable future. She is also listed as one of the 100 women globally co-creating a P2P, which is peer-to-peer society. So, Gene.
Yeah.
You and I have had conversations before about thrivability. Mm-hmm. I found an interview we had done before. But just for the benefit of the people who are listening to the podcast, can you define thrivability?
I hate it when people ask me this question.
I know. It's always the inevitable question, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, part of it is because I don't want there to be one definition. And I think it has to do with thrivability as a question, not an answer.
I always thought of it as saying like, well, it's just like sustainability, but on steroids. Yeah. Muscular sustainability.
You know, it does relate to sustainability in the sense of like, why would I want to sustain when I could thrive? And so it's in the same field of that. But it's also harder to like know what it is when it's not a straight line. And sustainability often has a lot to do with the environment, and thrivability also includes play and culture and art, or, you know, it's got a lot more dimensionality. Are we thriving if we just have a garden, or no, do we also need to have music and philosophy, right? Like, it includes more dimensionality than I think sustainability has traditionally included.
It's the liberal arts version of sustainability.
That's sort of true. That's sort of true. And a big piece of that to me has to do with creativity. Like, part of the reason I'm resistant to sustainability is it has this burden within it of this heaviness of what's gone wrong. And I don't think we're going to get to the creative solutions that we need if we're in the dread, right? Our minds work best when we're feeling creative and curious. And so how do we create words that evoke that for us and invite us into the question?
You know, that reminds me of the Viridian design movement. Do you remember that? So Bruce Sterling started that in, I guess it was 1999. And the idea was to bring designers and futurists and people from all forms of like creative life into the conversation about the environment and particularly about climate change, which we were just starting to be very aware of as a problem then. And the thing is that I think Bruce looked at the environmental movement and thought, man, these people are, they're just kind of dark, you know, it's kind of burlap. So it's like, let's put on some really nice shimmering material, you know, Viridian being a sort of metallic color of green. And he started the Viridian Design Movement. And the idea was really to make that conversation more creative and more appealing and more thrivable.
Yeah. Totally in line with that. I think part for me of why I was interested in thrivability comes from being a Midwesterner. And so there was like, how can I talk to sustainability to my Christian neighbor who may not have the same beliefs about the world that I do? You know, and they're more interested in having a good relationship with God. And they got all excited about thriving. That really landed for them. I've had more resistance from the environmentalists who are like, you're not really facing the problem at hand, than I have from people who are across the aisle from the progressives that I'm usually hanging out with.
Oh, that's kind of funny. I mean, I kind of wonder, it kind of includes sustainability. So why wouldn't it be addressing the problem at hand? Do we need to be tearing our hair out?
Yes, we should be ashamed of yourself.
I've got a lot of hair now, so I could I could make a project of that. I could stuff a pillow. So what are examples of projects that you think drive thrivability? Hopefully you know of some.
Yeah. So I'm in currently, probably since the last time we talked, I'm in a relationship with somebody who's in a Quaker intentional village. And so it's an intentional community whose explicit purpose is thrivability. And so it's been fantastic to be there because they've got the straw bale house and the living roof and all that kind of stuff going on. But they're also focused on relationship and being in the conversation. So I'm getting a whole bunch of Quaker process stuff, which I was not aware of how interested Quakers are in consent. And it's beautiful to be sitting in a conversation with people who really want everybody participating to be consenting. And the difference between consent and consensus, they're not trying to get everybody to believe the same thing.
Well, the thing you think about when, I mean, other than Oates, when you think about Quakers is peace, their dedication to peace and how so many Quakers became conscientious objectors. Yeah. So I guess I'm not surprised, you know, to hear that.
Yeah.
So what got them into it? Like, is this something that's been going on for a long time or is this a fairly new project for them?
It's been going on for almost 20 years. And I don't know when the thrivability got inserted into their core five premises. We have some conversation about whether that was my fault or not. So it's not like it's, you know, 50 years old or anything like that. No.
Can thrivability take root in our form of government the way it's set up right now?
The way it's set up right now, that's a good question. Possibly it could.
But, you know, we have so many different factions all vying for their own agendas, and it's kind of hard to come to a consensus on just about anything, even within parties. So what would it take to get something done?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. And getting a little bit of pushback from people because we've gotten so used to enjoying the polemic, you know, because I get to be right and I get to make somebody else wrong instead of going, so what really is at the core of what you're trying to accomplish? What is it that you're trying to protect? Who is it that you love? And I think we could move in a much different way if we were asking the, like, what is it that you're taking care of? And who is it that you love, instead of the, let me make you wrong, or I have to defeat you, the like antagonism. And instead, like, finding everybody's coming to this stuff from loving something. What is it that they love, and how can they make sure that that is taken care of? So I think part of it is switching that question from what are you against to, okay, so what are you for? What does that mean you're for? And asking why until you get to the real root, you know, because my mother X, because I have a child at home that has this struggle. You know, it's usually such a personal thing. And if we can hear that in each other, then I think we can come closer together. But I think a lot of that is driven too by a sense of uncertainty. We're all dealing with such a massively uncertain world that we're, you know, a little desperate for the solidity of the rightness. And there's a lot of emotion coming up about that uncertainty that makes it easy to slip into the anger that we have with each other. And so I'm wondering, what is it that we can do to live into uncertainty better? That would loosen some of the energy that's currently activating people.
So we were talking about government, and I know that you've talked about getting away from thinking in terms of structures and processes and more in terms of forms and flows. I wonder if that that kind of shift in thinking would have an impact on government. We might reinvent government here right now. As we speak,
I think there's lots of giants that we could stand on the shoulders of that have done some phenomenal work around governance. But it really makes me wonder, if we're looking at flows, where is the flow blocked and who's blocking it and why? You know, like if we take something like healthcare, most Americans think that we should have healthcare. It's ridiculous that that's not done. Why is that getting blocked? Who is blocking that?
It's a little hard to understand it. It appears to have something to do with some idea of the free enterprise system and how providing health care to everybody would somehow be inconsistent with the idea of free enterprise and the idea that health care should be like an economic engine of some kind. I kind of don't completely get it. I guess I'm not really a good free enterprise guy myself. I mean, I'm all for people going out and making a buck however they can do it. But I look around the world and I see how many countries have health care that's fairly universal for everybody in the country. And it's like, why can't we have that? In a way, we kind of do, because pretty much anybody can show up at an emergency room and get treated. And hospitals are kind of supposed to do that, and there are hospitals that will do that, you know, and they actually get at least, I mean, I used to work in Medicaid, and people got, there were hospital systems that got compensated for accepting or working with emergency situations for patients that had no income and couldn't pay, you know, and they would go ahead and treat them. But that shouldn't be like some kind of weird fail-safe approach that has everybody running to the emergency room for everything. There should be a way to make sure that everybody just has access, you know, and has access to really good care. Yeah. And it shouldn't be dependent on like some good guys setting up a free clinic downtown.
No. No, although I think when you asked in the preset something about like, where do I see things going? I'm like, mutual aid, because the government isn't being allowed to do the things that government can do. That's the big question, right? The Republicans have said the government doesn't do a good job of those things. It shouldn't be the government's job. Take that out of the vein. And there's some solid argument in like, why doesn't the government do a good job? How does bureaucracy end up becoming too large a scale? And why does scale become an issue? There's some solid questions in that space about how does that happen efficiently and effectively? True. And if we don't have good healthcare for all of us, then we end up funding each other through GoFundMes. We have people who get sick sooner because they aren't taken care of at the early part. And so then they get more and more sick with other things. And it's not good systemically. But I think we've lived in an age in which we've thought we're individuals that can operate individually, and not that like my neighbor getting sick actually has negative effects on me, or that healthcare issues in my county affect my health as well. And until we start to understand those systemic issues of like, it comes back, I'm going to have to pay into the system because the government is going to have to take care of that person that wasn't covered. Or my community is degrading because the healthcare isn't being taken care of. Like, if we don't understand those systemic effects, then we don't create the large base layer that really allows for enterprise to be functioning at a higher layer. I also think that enterprises shouldn't be burdened with health insurance either. Like, this is hard for small businesses. If you really want to have a thriving small business environment and encourage entrepreneurialism, then burdening those people with healthcare responsibilities doesn't seem like the right way to go either. So I think creating a base layer that allows individuals to operate and create business might be a better route to getting the free enterprise world that those people aspire to.
Yeah, I mean, there used to be the thought that at least we'd have Medicaid that would help people, but now there are attempts to strangle Medicaid programs, you know, and shove people off of those programs, and states refusing funds offered by the feds for Medicaid programs. And it's really hard to understand. Yeah, puzzling.
Yeah, when I looked into the universal basic income stuff, they're like, basically, it would be cheaper. We spend so much money trying to prevent the small number of cases of people taking advantage of the system that would be easier to just take care of them. Like, if you want financial efficiency, just take care of them. And then the system will function much more efficiently. But if you burden the government with having to find every bad actor and that's what they get tasked to do, then it's not a good system for anybody's experience, right?
It seems a lot of the bad actors are actually, when it comes to Medicare, Medicaid, are the providers. It's not the patients. The patients many times are recruited by bad actors to come in and we'll file a claim on your behalf, and you just need to shut up and not tell anybody if they ask you about it. Because I've encountered some of those groups in a previous life. I worked in healthcare. In the business side, and there was a lot of that going on, not unfortunately in our group, but we would hear from people saying, well, you know, someone told me if I came in and I signed these papers and went away that they were going to give me $50. And that was rampant and still is in many cases. There have been many situations like that here in Texas especially. But whenever you bring up, you know, getting a universal health care, immediately certain people will say, oh, that's socialism, that's communism. We can't allow that to happen in this country.
Yeah.
Medicare for all.
Absolutely.
Well, that kind of, just talking about sort of what's happening with governance politics right now kind of takes me to a question that I was going to ask later on, but I can kind of move it up here. And this is like asking you to respond with your NLP hat on, neurolinguistic programming. Mm-hmm. What's your take on the current really divisive uses of language that we see? And I'm thinking in particular about the evolution of the word woke and the concept of cancel culture and kind of what's been happening with those and how, you know, they started on the left and they were appropriated by the right and now they're becoming like a battleground.
Yeah, I've been super fascinated by a bunch of these words that both sides use, but they mean completely different things. And one of the first ones that I really noticed was deep state. And so if you read Edward Snowden's book, He talks about the deep state as those people who are in the government that continue to hold the government, even though we've got different people in office, and that it secures the continuity of our government. And that seems really important. And so I go, oh, deep state might be something that if I was one of those people, I would be honored to have that as a way of referring to me. But then it got used as this, like, no, there's bad actors that are running that program that are doing nasty things. Now let's associate that with some of the things that have come out about the CIA. And now we can make that into conspiracy theory material. But it's the same word. And when it's the same word, then both sides allow it to be used and they both keep it in their rhetoric. But they can mean completely different things. And so woke feels the same way to me, where it's like, oh, I am awake to the different oppressions in our culture. I am awake to my participation in it. Like, there can be a positive affirmation of acknowledging the, you know, having come out of the matrix to see the world as it is, right? And that's great to be woke in that way. But of course, then somebody takes it on as that's my identity and then starts brandishing it around like a sword in the world. And so I think of it as it's moving into phase two, right? The initial birth of the word might have some positive way of speaking, but then it gets tangled into an identity, which gets leveraged against somebody else. So I'm woke and you're not. Who isn't? And how can I then awaken you or make you bad for not being it? And so then it starts to become a leverage, right? And that's not, it's not a healthy energy, not very woke, if you ask me. And then the right is just really good at taking language like that and twisting it around. And so the right to me has been so good at cancel culture. They are so good at saying, you won't do this, you will do this, you'll wear this, you won't wear that. Like, they control culture and want to limit and oppress people with their own views, abortion being one of the big ones that comes to mind. Because of my religion, you can't do this thing with your body. And now they're going to be defensive about
the victims now.
Yeah, they're the ultimate victims, right? And the quote unquote woke people are like, I'm trying to hold you accountable for things that you're doing. Like, you refuse to see how you're hurting me. And now both sides can use it to press against each other and make wrong, and talk right past each other using the same words. Same words. And this to me was really interesting with Trump too, because he would say both sides of the story so that everybody had the soundbite that they wanted. Just fascinating.
It was kind of funny to see the obsession with those Dr. Seuss books that were, you know, kind of removed from print as a racial sensitivity issue. And they weren't that popular or anything like that. But it was like, it was as though somebody had piled those books up in the middle of town and set fire to them. You know, it was characterized as a book burning. And I think you and I both know people who were sucked into that, and I kept thinking, dude, you're buying into right-wing talking points. You're not really thinking critically about this. You're kind of going overboard. And that was one of the concerns I had, was that rhetorically the right was having some success at taking people who had normally been not necessarily on the right, maybe at the center or even the left, and sort of pulling them into their world and into their reality and into these conversations. And cancel culture was a good way to do that, because it's really about free speech. And, you know, the left and the right both have concerns about free speech. So the right had found a way to get allies from the left, I guess.
Yeah. So in the Thrivability Breaking Through to a World That Works book, I start with this notion of there's a folding that's happening where parts of the left are combining with parts of the right. And on the positive end, I think of things like social entrepreneurship, where there's a section on the right that says in a free enterprise. If we're going to do good, we should make money while doing it. Let me start a social entrepreneurial venture and I can make dollars while I do good in the world, because that's how good should be done. And the left is saying it's hard to get the right grants. Like, how can I help my revenue stream to actually make this a viable opportunity so I can deliver the good that I want to have in the world? And they meet at the same conferences and have good conversations together, and it's a beautiful thing. But this, to me, is the dark side of the left and the right coming together. There's a which group is with which, and what used to be the left is no longer really recognizable as the left, and what used to be the right doesn't seem to be recognizable to many of the people that I know and love on the right. It's all gotten shaken up. And so the new allegiances are forming around these types of things, I think. And there's a real battle for the language that will recruit people to the new polls.
It seems like what we're seeing is words as a weapon rather than just speaking with each other. We find weapon words and throw them at each other rather than trying to actually get to the heart of whatever it is that we're discussing. How do we get away from using words as a weapon?
What's the energy underneath that, right? There's fear underneath. Like, why would I need a weapon anyway? I need it to protect something. So there's a lot of anxiety and fear right now. As I said earlier about uncertainty, we're facing an immense amount of uncertainty. And the environmental movement has made it clear, like, climate crisis is a real thing and you should be afraid. And so if I grew up in a world thinking that I might leave something for my children, I'm now anxious about what world that might be. If I grew up as a Christian mother who wants to have, you know, her children raised in the religion, then I'm more and more afraid of what they're able to see on TV. Like, there's lots of reasons for people on all sides to be more afraid than ever. And fear generates money in terms of advertising. Like, it just gets accelerated.
And votes.
So how do we face the fear? And how do we hold each other in our fear? And come together. And we can do this in small community, and we do it really well when we're in small community and when we are in family. But social media and such has driven us further apart. Like, we don't have the containers of love that can move us through that energy. So I think we need to have more dinners. But COVID is making that even harder than ever, right? Like, it's harder than ever to be held and to go to family dinner and be like, really, Uncle Jack is an okay person. You know, he's playing very well with my niece, and bring love back into the conversation.
Well, I think that we had a sort of blurring of cultures that was happening, and people were starting to come together and starting to think of, you know, the whole earth. I'm definitely an old whole earther. Global culture, that it, like globalism, which is now a bad word. All of this stuff was happening. And, you know, when you thought about mixing cultures, you really thought about hybrid vigor. Mm. And I think partly as a result of social media exposing so much of so many things to so many people, and also giving a voice to so many people, somehow fear emerged from all that. And suddenly there was a desire not to like blend energies, but to find opposition and to reinforce borders and to get the immigrants out of here. And I mean, that really seems to be something that was evolving. And some people talk about Trump bringing that on, but actually I think that the reason he was able to get elected is that he was, I mean, I think he was a symptom and not a cause.
Yeah, totally. Totally agree with you. It's a symptom.
So I think, you know, there's a big question about how do you get people back on the same page, and what is social media's role in all this, and how could that be fixed? I know you've got a solution.
It feels like such a maturity question, right? Like, what can we hold together? And I often think, you know, when I'm watching people get in fights over this stuff, like, oh, we're just acting like teenagers, right? And
it's true.
We're just really acting like teenagers, and our brains are a little fried from the new chemistry of the rush of drugs, from the feeling of connection or identity statements or whatever that comes with. And so this phase two shall pass. I really am convinced that this phase will pass. Will we still have large scale stuff? I don't know. I feel like the largeness of the how big that public is part of what skews things funny. And the energy of negativity moves much faster than the energy of connection and the trust building that it takes to be in long-term relationship with each other. So, but you'll still find plenty of places in the internet in which you can find deeper connection and hold long-term relationship. And I know that you know that quite well, John, as you've been parts of those places. Yeah. And what will we evolve in order to support that? And can it be financially viable? Like, if we can't get right regulation in to curb the things that are skewing us awry, then can we make money, which we need to support the endeavors that would hold the right containers for us? Or do we need to educate people to know what to look for? You know, find community in which there's real feedback loops, because you can't have anonymous actors coming in and just spewing garbage all over the place.
Well, it's getting harder because there's so many voices getting into our heads right now. We have so much media exposure, and, you know, I often argue that, I mean, people who are knocking mainstream media don't really understand that mainstream media has a tradition of like journalistic ethics and vetting stories and fact checking and all that. But really, I've been kind of watching what's happening lately, and I think that mainstream media is definitely falling down on the job. And I don't think the solution to that is to start paying attention to, you know, your favorite set of bloggers or I mean, there's bloggers I pay attention to. I pay a lot of attention to Cory Doctorow, for instance. But our heads fill up with things. It's hard to really, a lot of people don't really think critically. And it's hard to think critically. And it's especially hard to think critically if there's a high volume noise blasting into your head.
Yeah, I hear that.
And what does that do to thrivability, really? The fact that we're so, I guess the word for where we are is kind of disoriented, really.
Yeah, but think about what happens in a teenager's brain, right? Like, they're doing all this growth and there's weird chemicals rushing around and they're pubescent, and it's we're doing that. But we're also learning, you know, like, I've watched my kid grow up with Tumblr and the negative effects that Tumblr had on them as a child. And yet I also see them growing beyond that. And I watch how they hold their friends and have started, you know, having particular boundaries around, we're going to focus on what we're going to do to make things better and not just vent at each other. And, like, there's real maturity that's growing in that space, in that generation, around how to handle social media. And so I have a lot of faith that this is just a phase. I think media has gotten skewed because they have to do whatever is going to get eyeballs, and that it's just, I don't know. To me, advertising comes down as the core problem here. We're competing for eyeballs, for advertising, in a way that's not aligned with the right incentives. And so how can we come together to create different incentives? And some of that is about individuals making different choices. And I see people doing that. I see people signing off of social media all the time and going, I'm not coming back. This is not the energy I want in my life. Or I'm coming back once a week and I'm on a social media diet, because more than that is just not good for my vibe. And so they're reclaiming their own. It's like they're doing the individuation work that we all need to do as we come into the public space. And so it's a brutal phase. It really feels brutal, but I think it will pass.
What we've been seeing in social media, the bad things that are happening, really had a root in the old media of radio and television, specifically the talk shows. I used to listen to those just to see what was going on. And the people you would hear calling in to Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck or any of those characters, they were always saying the same thing. They're going to take my guns. They're going to make me wear a turban. They're going to make me marry my cousin. And I would listen to this, and I'm like, seriously? But once these people had their own means of getting that same message out on social media, then it all went to hell in a handbasket. And suddenly the gates had been open and all the crazies are loose. And I don't see any way to really do anything about that other than not paying attention to it, find attention somewhere else.
Yeah. It's like a train wreck and everybody's got to watch.
Yeah. And media requires controversy, you know, especially mainstream media. If you're not controversial, you're not going to get the eyeballs of the listeners, the eyeballs and the ears of the listeners. Yeah. And so you have to be controversial. Someone who's being, you know, even-tempered and saying the right, you know, things that have been well-researched, they're going to be thrown off the air because they're not getting the controversy.
Yeah, I wonder if that's still true, though, if people are so traumatized by the last phase that they're eager for something even-tempered and calm and reliable and soothing. And they may not stay on it for hours and hours on end, but I think they're looking for it.
Well, I mean, in that vein, one thing that I did notice was when we had Snowvid here, as we've been calling it, the snowpocalypse, and it was such a terrible time. People didn't have power. They didn't have water. And I saw tons of people online stepping up and offering to do all kinds of things for people, offering water, offering to help, you know, if you needed to get somewhere, I got a four-wheel drive, whatever. And the sense I had, just from the vibe around these offerings, was that people were relieved to be in a situation where they could stop fighting and help instead, you know, offer help to people.
Yeah. Yeah. At the root, I suspect that we're in a massive identity crisis. And I just don't mean Black Lives Matter. I mean, we used to have a sense of place, a sense of our church or religious affiliation. We used to have a single job or, you know, like a career that wouldn't be the job changes that we have now. We used to have slower movement in politics, like all these forms of our identity. That felt like they were very slow moving and solid and consistent have been thrown into question in the last 50, 70 years in a way that I don't think our brains have been wired for. And advertising has made that even worse, right? You're not who you think you are. You need our product in order to be the person who's going to be loved and cared for. And the strange thing about that is in times of crisis, we really do have a beautiful sense of ourselves as showing up and being a contribution and helping our neighbors. And Corey has talked about this somewhat too in beautiful ways, right? Because he's also inspired. I'm looking over at The Hope in the Dark by Rebecca Solnit. Because we do come together and those moments, we feel like we're great people. Like being a contribution to others is one of the greatest things you can do for your own sense of identity. Just, I did a good thing. I helped somebody today. And it's way better than I bought the new clothes, I bought the new car. None of those things will satisfy. Even your job changes won't be as satisfying as the, like, I contributed to those people around me. I'm in community with them. And so there's ways in which we thought we would get that through social media, and I think some groups have done so. But we need lots of maturity in that space so that we can find how to be a contribution to one another, because that's one of our greatest... the greatest things that will soothe the anxiety that's underneath all of that.
Yeah, I guess one thing that we could do, like those of us who are kind of have some degree of awareness of the problem, is to really work hard at avoiding buying into any kind of divisive rhetoric or, you know, creating contention. Somebody was talking today on The Well. I mean, The Well is an online community where there's still great conversation happening, right? Yeah. And somebody was talking about the difference between having an argument and having a discussion. And when you're having an argument, one side or another wants to win, you know, but when you're having a discussion, nobody has to win. Everybody wins. And we have more arguments than discussions now.
Yeah. Yeah. One simple trick for people, if they're looking for, like, how do I know whether I'm in it, is it an A or B situation? If it's A or B, then you're forced to pick one of those two and they're both wrong. So don't do it. Go, what about C? What about D? What about E? You know, what other options are in the space, and avoid the false binaries that we get pushed into.
Ooh, I think I have a new project. So I would like to talk about, this is more related to some of the work that you do, but I'm just kind of wondering, I know you worked with organizations some, and how can organizations find ways to sort of liberate ideas internally versus suppressing them? I mean, are there particular methods for doing that, ways that an organization can operate so that the people within the organization are not held down or held back, but they actually become more vital to the organization and more participatory?
Yeah. Well, a lot of it means leadership really believing that that matters, and not doing some superficial gesture in that direction, but really being open to whatever that means. The places where I've seen it actually cared for are doing bizarre things. Like they're going, oh, people need to bump into each other. And so how do we arrange physical space so that people have to have a conversation in the hallway? Because you need the random-y kind of conversation to do things. One of my friends, and I think one of yours, John, is somebody who worked at Bell Labs, and his first day at the job, he tells the story. The first day at the job, his boss got him in the elevator and they took apart the buttons and reprogrammed which floor you would go to. And it was just such an introduction to, this is a culture that's going to be a little trickstery. It's going to be playful. Don't take yourself too seriously. That invited so much creativity. He also tells stories about having Friday afternoon jams and not having to make those so focused on a deliverable, like not trying to measure a result out of it all of the time or in the short term. And we've gotten such a pressure for short-termism that we're losing the space that it takes to be really creative. And so you can't just mix the people up. You also have to give them real permission to do the messy work of creativity, because it's not a spreadsheet. It doesn't work like a spreadsheet. It's messy and playful, and it doesn't work when you put a ton of pressure on it. You've got to loosen it up and try and create something whimsical. And so, I don't know, for the boss that's trying to create that in his organization or in his team, I'm like, wear some funky socks, put a strange hat on, like show in some visual and tangible ways. And I'm super curious about how this happens when we're more work from home. You know, like, what are you creating in your background that's sending a message of like, please be playful? Here's one of mine for you. I can put my little Lego person here, and right, like, how do you encourage the playfulness to like really come out so that we can be silly together? Because that's where we're going to come up with a wild idea.
Mickey Mouse. Yeah, we did a Lego thing at the co-op that I was part of when we were having a retreat and trying to think of something to do. So I bought a Lego architecture kit. It was a Frank Lloyd Wright house, and we built that together. It was great, you know. Those retreats were great. I mean, we definitely loosened up at those retreats. And I've worked for other organizations that kind of had ways of doing that, but I've found surprising instances where that doesn't happen at all, I guess. Yeah. There was another thing I thought of a minute ago. Do you know Verna Ali? Are you familiar with her work?
No.
With value networks? Mm-hmm. So basically what she was talking about is how companies don't measure the non-financial value of relationships. I mean, that was part of what she was talking about. Yeah. And I suppose one way to do that is to kind of figure out how to get that on the books.
Yeah. Yeah. So yes to that. And also there's something about the phasing of things. Like now is time for connecting. You're not supposed to get some work done. You're just to connect. Or now is some time for generating ideas together. It's not whether those ideas are viable. Like really the Disney creative strategies keep it a clear distinction between the generation of the idea, the checking of the idea, and the making the idea rigorous and effective, so that you're putting different, you're not shutting yourself down with your editor. It's like when you're trying to do creative writing, if you've got your editor hat on, you just struggle through the thing. But if instead you like allow yourself to just freely like, and then come back later and bring your editor in so that it can refine the idea. And so if you've got a meeting where somebody is coming in with editor energy, they'll stop the creative process and you won't have your wildest, most wonderful ideas come through. So really pushing the editor phase back and giving room for the generative phase to start is really crucial, in my opinion.
You know, I've encountered people who in a business environment are really frightened of things that open things up and loosen the communications of among people. I was in a project doing quality assurance testing for a big system. And I convinced everyone to work in a big open area where we're all together, where we can just sit there and talk and exchange ideas. And it just worked great. But there were a couple of people who really hated it because they wanted a damn office. They wanted to be able to say, I've got my own office right over there in the corner. And it was just horrible. And finally, when this project was over and we transitioned into production, everybody got an office. And communication disappeared. Everybody was in their little silo, and never the twain shall meet. So you have to be careful with what you ask for. Sometimes it has a bad outcome.
Yeah. But so we've got different people coming together, and some of them are more introverted, and they might need the quiet space of the office. Some of them are very power oriented, and so they need the corner office. And if you take that away from them, then they're resistant. And so trying to listen to the different dynamics and make spaces so that you're not fixed. Okay, you've got an office, but then we do community jams where we all come together and have a conversation. And I feel like business has often gone whole hog in one direction and then going, nope, we're going to now turn and go completely orthogonal. And it's like, what's the right way that we can allow that there are introverts and extroverts and do things in a variety of ways so that we get more out of all of us instead of just prioritizing one type of us? That's part of why I was saying the editor phase. Like, we still need the editor phase. It just needs to be demarcated so that there's time for that.
So maybe part of the solution, and I know you're onto this, is creating a more of a culture of play within an organization. How do you do that?
Yeah. And asking, like, what does play look like for different people? Some people are really into role playing. And so they might want to do like a little skit, like, oh, there's some bad energy in the office. And can we do just a little skit to like show how that looks and some like playback theater kind of energy so we can work that out. Whereas somebody else is like, well, I need to go into my office and put my headphones on and not have anybody interrupt me for 4 hours straight so I can think through this problem. Like, there's lots of different ways in which that needs to show up. But I think listening to what people feel called to do and, mixing it up without trying to come up with like, well, there's one right way to do it. There's no one right way. There's what's alive in your organization, what is called for, and how do you create the space for the brightest answer to rise to the top, rather than having somebody dictate that there's only one way and it's only fits for a portion of the people involved or the portion of the problems that you're facing.
I guess part of the problem is that in any organizational context, you may have a whole group of people who are completely dedicated to the work, but then you might have somebody in there who's dedicated to the positioning or to, you know, their place in the company and moving up and whatever. And they can kind of bring a kind of toxicity to the environment, I guess. Politics really kind of ruins things.
It does. And yet we don't understand, like, how do you leverage that? So this is a little bit more of a spiritual thing to say, but I think of ego being like a dog, right? And a lot of traditions are like, well, you got to get rid of the ego. And I think those political people are kind of like the organizational ego. Like, and how do you walk that dog? Where are those people good for? How do you help the organization take advantage of the ego that it has so that you, you know, get in front of the right clients, or you move the project towards the right goals, or, you know, you get the materials to be polished and shiny because that's going to get us in front of or win this award or whatever. Like, how do you give that a healthy avenue? Instead of having it turn internal, because the energy is there, you're not going to like exercise it out of the space. Yeah, I think that you'll find lots of my answers are it's contextual. It depends. How can you be creative? How do you listen to the wisdom that's there? And how do you work with the system as it is rather than try and work against it?
Yeah, I totally get that. I've never been in a situation that was like any other situation, and I've never been around any people who were like any other people, you know. Yeah, there's so much diversity in both like people and in situations. And I've been in work situations that were pretty toxic and seemed almost incurable, but I've been in work situations that were like just kind of wonderful and highly creative. And, you know, that's kind of where I was thinking about when I mentioned the thing about the political person in there, that the work situations that are most toxic are the ones where people are really focused on their position or their role or getting advantages or whatever, and really aren't thinking as much about what they're there for, you know, the task at hand. And actually, oddly, I was just thinking about how I used to work for a state agency, and it was one of the least toxic environments I'd been in because everybody had a real sense of mission. We were working with poverty programs, and everybody was kind of there to get the job done. And every now and then you would have somebody who would start playing politics a bit, but they tended to be sort of drowned out by the volume of the dedication to work, you know, that you had within the overall commonality. So I guess, oh, go ahead.
I hear that, and I feel like this is one of my more recent lessons, because normally I would have said the same thing that you just said. But I'm wondering if maybe that toxicity is toxic to you, not toxic itself. It's toxic to you because you're more interested in affiliation. And some other people might be more interested in achievement. And so the things that you want to experience and have in the organization are not supported by that behavior. And so it feels toxic to you. And so the question isn't whether it itself is, but whether it is for you. And so which environments are great for you? And when we stop saying it's the thing and instead go, what's my relationship to it? Then it's a different kind of conversation about like, well, what's really the mission we're trying to achieve together? And how do we have different people play into that mix? And if we're in community together, we can have that conversation.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Because it is very easy to think that your experience is a reflection of some universal thing, you know, and not just your experience, you know. Just like sometimes it's hard to understand that the voices in your head are not always friendly. I saw this really great film at South by Southwest last week called Violet. Justine Bateman made it. And it was about a woman named Violet who worked in the film industry. And the way that they did the film was that she had a voice in her head, and it was a male voice, incidentally, and the voice was constantly criticizing. So that was one voice in her head. But there was another set of thoughts that were represented by writing on the screen. And those were sort of like the positive thoughts. And what you saw in the film was an evolution where you saw her positive thinking overcome her negative thinking, basically. And you could just kind of watch her evolve as a person. I've never seen anything quite like it. And it really brought up some thoughts for me about how, you know, how I can get so mired in my own self-talk that I don't realize that those voices are not real. You know, I mean, if you're a Buddhist, you kind of start to understand that pretty well, but you can still forget it pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really captivated by voice dialogue stuff. I don't know if you've heard of that process, but it started as a psychological process to just what are the voices that are in there and move through. It's like, oh, there's my inner critic. And what is the positive purpose of the inner critic? What is he looking out for? So, yeah, he's like, rah, 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 rah. And like, I started listening to like, oh, so what is that trying to do for me? And now you hear it in my talk about how to do an organization, right? It's like, okay, so what's the positive purpose of that person that's behaving in that way? And how do you use that to your advantage? But it comes from having done it at an inner level through voice dialogue stuff about like, oh, that inner critic is trying to make me look good. Oh, and me resenting that is not helping, right? Like, but he's a little over the top about it. So how do I partner him with other pieces of myself so that he can have his goal of making me look good happen, but without doing the harm that it feels like with the way he's rah, 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 at me?
What can make it really hard is that he's not necessarily just a voice, but also an emotion.
Yeah.
An emotional attachment, you know, tends to sort of be hard to deal with.
I found that my inner critic is a parent in some cases. Like, is that my dad telling me that, or is that my idea? And I have to sit down and go, well, I better think about this. Who's the boss around here? And that's sometimes an interesting discussion, trying to figure out these voices may not be your voice. They may be someone that's influenced you along the way.
Totally, totally. You've internalized, this is what my mother would say here, until it becomes, I just hear it as if it's me. Yeah. Or your father or whatever. Yeah, totally. Totally get that. But it's not like, how do I get rid of them? But like, what is the role that they serve and how do I want them? Like, what's my inner governance and how does that inner governance work to help me be the person that we want to be? And the more that they're doing research on psychological stuff like this, they're finding this is true for most of us. We have a rich inner dialogue of many different voices. The attempt to even say we're a single self is something of an illusion that we need to work on.
Yeah, one thing you try to do with meditation is to hear those voices and put them in context into your attachment. Oh, yeah, the self illusion. I think I have a copy of that book, actually.
Yeah.
And I think I have that illusion. Delusion. Deluded.
Indeed.
Well, this is probably a good point to wrap up. We really appreciate your taking time to talk to us today. This has been a fun discussion. Lots to think about.
Thank you for having me. It was a joy.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.